The ongoing UN Conference on Climate Change is expected to produce a landmark global agreement during the next 2 weeks. But what are the politics of climate change in this country? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Later this hour, Dennis Goldford of Drake University analyzes the politics of climate change in this country and how the presidential candidates see it differently. Before that, a conversation that my colleague Pat Blank had with Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz. Cruz is surging in the Iowa polls and closing in on frontrunner Donald Trump. Politics Wednesday is straight ahead. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're starting off this Politics Wednesday a little bit differently this week. A little later, Dennis Goldford of Drake University will be along with his analysis. But first, a Quinnipiac poll last week showed Republican presidential hopeful Senator Ted Cruz of Texas surging here in Iowa, closing in on frontrunner Donald Trump. IPR's All Things Considered host Pat Blank caught a ride with Cruz to Amana Sunday night after a campaign stop in Van Horn and asked him about some of the issues that are top of mind for Iowans 2 months out from the caucuses.
You're listening to Iowa Public Radio. I'm Pat Blank. And as we have been doing along the campaign trail, we've been catching up with presidential candidates when we have the time, and they have the time to spend a few minutes with us other than just a quick soundbite. And I am traveling with Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz. And thank you so much for allowing me to ride along with you for a while this afternoon.
Well, Pat, it's great to be with you, and thank you for joining us.
So the big news is Ted Cruz is on the rise. The Quinnipiac poll shows that you now are at 23%, just a couple behind the front runner. So what happened?
Well, it's very encouraging, and it's a trend that we've been seeing happening steadily over the last several months, which is that conservatives are uniting behind our campaign. You know, I think if you look historically at the Republican primary, there have been two major lanes. There's been a moderate lane and a conservative lane. And typically in past Republican primaries, there's been one consensus moderate candidate, and all the money gets behind that candidate. And then on the Republican side, there tend to be a whole bunch, or on the conservative side, rather, there tend to be a whole bunch of us. Nobody has any money, and we fight like cats and dogs. And as a result, typically in prior elections, the moderate goes on to win the nomination, and then they lose the general because millions of conservatives stay home all over the country. And one of the things I am most encouraged about is this election cycle, that entire dynamic is reversed. This election cycle, if you look at the moderates, there are four, five, or six of them that are completely divided. They've got millions of dollars apiece, and I think they're going to spend that money ripping each other apart. Right now, the moderates are acting like conservatives normally act. And then on the conservative side, something remarkable has happened. You look at the candidates who've dropped out of the race, Rick Perry, Scott Walker, Bobby Jindal, all good men, good governors. All three were competing primarily in the conservative lane. You look at other candidates who were expected to be formidable in the conservative lane, they're not getting meaningful traction. And so what we've been seeing happening steadily is conservatives uniting behind our campaign. And I think if that continues to happen, I believe that will put us on a path to win the nomination. And that is also the key to winning the general election, is bringing back to the polls the millions of conservatives who stayed home in 2008 and 2012. We've got to give them a reason to come back.
There's still a lot of candidates on the Republican ticket. And how do you distinguish yourself and stay on top of the polls to make sure people realize who you are?
You know, there are a lot of candidates, but I think we are seeing the field winnow down in front of us. As I mentioned, we've had three Republicans drop out already. And if you look at the field nationally, there are only four Republicans who are in double digits. And everyone else is in low single digits. Everyone else is 4% or below. As a practical matter, you're seeing the field narrow down. The four candidates who are in double digits are Donald Trump, Ben Carson, Marco Rubio, and myself. And I think you are seeing more and more as the candidates, as the voters begin studying the records of each candidate. And as we get closer and closer to the caucuses, voters start taking more and more time. They go to a town hall like one we just left, where they get a chance to look in the eyes of a candidate, to ask a question, to take the measure of the person. And they begin studying the records. And I think the more that happens, the more we will see what is happening here in Iowa, which is conservatives coalescing behind our campaign. And the reason is simple. I think people are tired of what I call campaign conservatives, which is people who talk a good game on the campaign trail. You know, on the debate stage, everyone says they're a conservative. That's what everyone always says. But I think voters recognize the difference between campaign conservatives and a consistent conservative, someone who has been the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. If we're going to win, we have to nominate a candidate who has been a fiscal conservative, a social conservative, and a national security conservative. All three legs of the proverbial conservative stool. And my record is markedly different from everyone else on that stage in that regard, of being a consistent conservative who doesn't just talk a good game on the trail, but has walked the walk, and in particular has taken on Washington, not just Democrats, but leaders in my own party, to stand and fight for the Constitution and fight for the people. And I think that's why conservatives are every day more and more consolidating behind our campaign.
Let's talk a little bit about your experience. You have less than 3 years in the Senate, no leadership experience as many of the others do as far as being a governor. So how do you take that to the White House and make that workable for you?
Well, I very much agree with you that I'm not a career politician. And there are people in this race who have been in elected office since their 20s. And their entire life has been as an elected politician. That's not me. The first office I was ever elected to was the United States Senate 3 years ago. Prior to that, I'd never been elected to nothing. Indeed, I joked the last thing I was elected to before that was student council. But that being said, unlike Barack Obama, I did not come to the U.S. Senate after being a community organizer. I had spent many, many years leading and fighting for the Constitution and fighting for principles. In particular, I spent 5.5 years as the Solicitor General of Texas, which is the chief lawyer for the state of Texas, representing the state before the United States Supreme Court and all the state and federal appellate courts. And during my tenure as Solicitor General, over and over again, Texas led the nation fighting for conservative principles and winning. So, for example, we defended the Ten Commandments monument that stands on the state capitol grounds. We went to the U.S. Supreme Court. We won 5-4. We defended the Pledge of Allegiance, the words "One Nation Under God." We went to the U.S. Supreme Court. We won unanimously. We defended the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms. We went to the U.S. Supreme Court. We won 5-4. And the biggest case of my tenure as Solicitor General, we stood up to the World Court and the United Nations and the President of the United States, who happened to be a Republican, George W. Bush, and we defended U.S. sovereignty. I argued this case twice in front of the United States Supreme Court. And the court ended up ruling entirely in our favor, concluding, number one, that neither the World Court nor the United Nations have any authority whatsoever to bind the U.S. justice system. And number two, that no president of the United States, either Democrat or Republican, has the constitutional authority to give up U.S. sovereignty. That was the record I ran on when I ran for Senate. But in addition to that, I spent 5 years as a partner at one of the largest law firms in the nation, where I led our U.S. Supreme Court practice and national appellate practice. And I represented major companies in bet the company litigation, cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, where we won over and over again. And I'll tell you the case I'm most proud of during my time in private practice was I represented over 3 million veterans pro bono for free defending the Mojave Desert Veterans Memorial. This is a lone white Latin cross. It was erected over 70 years ago to honor the men and women who gave their lives in World War I. The ACLU sued seeking to tear down that veterans memorial. The district court ordered the memorial torn down. The Court of Appeals ordered the memorial torn down. I represented 3 million veterans before the United States Supreme Court defending that veterans memorial, and we won 5-4, preserving it to honor the men and women who gave their lives for our nation.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about education.
Sure.
We had a struggle in the legislative session here in Iowa this year over education. You've talked about taking the federal government out of education. Why do you feel so strongly about having the federal government step away from education?
Well, let me say first of all that education is really foundational to opportunity for everyone. In my family, education has opened doors. My mother comes from an Irish-Italian family. She was the first person in her family ever to go to college. My father fled Cuba after he was imprisoned and tortured fighting in the revolution in Cuba. And when he came to America, he came to the University of Texas, and it was education that gave him the opportunity to work with my mother to start a small business and to work towards the American dream. So education is foundational to the miracle of this nation that has allowed so many millions of people with nothing to achieve anything. It is precisely because education is so important that I believe we need to get the federal government out of education, that education decisions should be made at the state level and the local level, where parents and teachers have direct input on what's being taught to their kids. If I'm elected president, I have pledged in the opening days of my administration that I will instruct the Federal Department of Education that Common Core ends today. And the reason is simple. We should not have a national curriculum decided by bureaucrats in Washington. The people of Iowa know what the children of Iowa should be taught, and you have a much better sense of the values and mores and needs of the community. I'll give you another example that shows just how disconnected Washington is from the men and women of this country. We've seen in recent weeks how the Federal Department of Education is trying to force a junior high to let a little boy shower with junior high girls. Now, I got to say, I'm the father of two daughters, and that's just nuts. My youngest daughter, Catherine, is 5. She understands the difference between a boy and a girl. And, you know, if a local Iowa school board issued an order saying the junior high has to let a boy shower with the girls, the people of Iowa would throw them out on their rear ends in a New York minute. The problem is when the decision is being made by some bureaucrat in the bowels of a building in Washington, they're not accountable to the people of Iowa or the people of Texas or anywhere else. They don't care what the parents think. And I think we need to bring those educational decisions back to the community level where parents have a direct say in what's being taught to our kids.
Senator Cruz, one of the things that sets you apart from many of the other candidates is that you're not a big fan of the renewable fuel standard. Yeah. Ethanol is a big deal here in Iowa. What do you say to people who depend on ethanol for their living?
Well, listen, I support ethanol and I support biofuels. I'm when it comes to energy policy, I believe in all of the above. I think God has blessed this country with enormous resources, and we should be pursuing everything. We should be pursuing oil and gas and coal and wind and solar and nuclear and biofuels and ethanol and everything. But I don't think we should have Washington picking winners and losers. That when you have politicians putting in place a mandate, what it ends up doing is empowering those politicians. And so I believe we should phase out the ethanol mandate, and I've introduced legislation to do that. Now, you know, I was recently, some months ago, I was at a large agriculture summit here in Iowa, and just about every Republican presidential candidate came to it. And we were all asked the same question: what is your view on the ethanol mandate? And every other candidate, including a number who had previously come out against the ethanol mandate, did a 180 flip in the air, and boom, suddenly they supported it. And my answer to them was exactly the same as what I just told you right now. And to be honest, when I said that, I didn't know if I'd get booed. I didn't know if they'd throw tomatoes at me. I mean, this was 1,000 of the largest ethanol producers in the state. And what I said to folks then is I said, listen, I recognize that a lot of y'all here might prefer that I said I'm for the ethanol mandate forever and ever, amen. But every one of us has seen politicians who tell one group one thing and tell another group another thing. And we know what happens. They go to Washington and they don't do what they said. And what I told folks there is, with me, you can count on me for two things. Number one, I'm going to tell you the truth. And number two, I'm going to do what I said I would do. And the group at the summit burst into applause. And when I left the stage, I got a standing ovation from the largest producers of ethanol in the state after saying we should phase it out. I think people are fed up with politicians who they can't trust. And when it comes to ethanol, listen, ethanol is a mature product in the marketplace. There is a real demand for ethanol. It will continue to be demanded in the energy market without a federal government mandate. And I do think there is an important role for the federal government in helping expand market access. So if you look right now at how the EPA is putting in place the blend wall that is preventing refineries from increasing the ethanol content of fuel, I don't think that makes any sense at all. And so when it comes to, and this is a point that I've made a number of times, when it comes to standing with the men and women of Iowa against the federal government, making it harder for farmers and ranchers to produce their crops to succeed, there is no one who will fight harder. But at the same time, if we're going to stand against all of the different subsidies, then it needs to be on a level playing field for everyone pursuing all of the above, and that's exactly what I intend to do.
Governor Terry Branstad is one of about 30 governors nationwide who have said, all right, stop the process of bringing Syrian refugees into the state of Iowa. Talk about what roles should a governor be able to say, stop that process?
Well, I salute the governor for standing up and taking that common sense position. And in my view, President Obama and Hillary Clinton's proposal to bring tens of thousands of Syrian Muslim refugees to America is utter lunacy. It makes no sense whatsoever. If we look at the refugees that are streaming into Europe, one study showed that 77% of those refugees were young men. That is a very unusual demographic profile for a refugee wave. We know that at least one of the terrorists who attacked Paris came in among those refugees, and that ISIS intends to infiltrate those refugees. And we also know that the head of the FBI told Congress that the Obama administration cannot vet these refugees to determine if they are terrorists. As he put it, he said, we don't have the information about who in Syria is part of ISIS. So he said, I can query the database until the cows come home. There's no information to check it against. We cannot vet these people. Given that, it makes no sense to bring to this country refugees who we do not know if they are terrorists, particularly given that ISIS intends to wage jihad against America to commit the same sort of horrific terror attacks that we saw in Paris. They intend to commit those murders here in America. Now, it was several months ago that I came out publicly against President Obama and Hillary Clinton's plan to bring tens of thousands of Syrian Muslim refugees to America. When I did, there was a fair amount of criticism by Democrats and by the media for my saying that. And I will say, I have been very encouraged in recent weeks. As you noted, over 30 governors, both Republicans and Democrats, have come to agree with my position. And that is encouraging to see a bipartisan consensus. And the reason is it's a common sense position. The first obligation of the president as commander-in-chief is to keep this country safe. And bringing in individuals who we do not know if they're jihadist is not consistent with that. Now let me note one other thing. It is entirely possible to protect this nation from terrorists and at the same time be compassionate to the plight of others. There is no doubt that we are witnessing a humanitarian catastrophe in Syria, and in many ways that is the result of the failures of the Obama-Clinton foreign policy that's allowed the rise of radical Islamic terrorism, that has allowed the rise of ISIS. But these refugees should be resettled in the Middle East, in majority Muslim countries. And I would note that America provides roughly $1.2 billion to resettle these refugees. That is more than 10 times what the next closest country provides. And so when you hear elected Democrats that are suggesting that the American people are somehow less than compassionate, I have to admit it gets me angry, because we are an incredibly compassionate country, giving over $1 billion to care for these people, 10 times more than any other country. And we do not need the President of the United States lecturing the American people that we are not compassionate simply because we want our president to keep this country safe.
We always like to wrap up these interviews that we do with candidates by saying, what are one or two or three words that come to your mind when you think about Iowa?
Real, personal, down-to-earth, honest. The values of Iowa are extraordinary. I have to admit, I've really grown to love this state. I committed several months ago to doing the full Grassley, to going to all 99 counties. You and I were talking about these 3 days. We're going to be in 16 counties in Iowa. We're going around the clock. And the support we're seeing on the ground. We were at a Casey's last night in Sheridan at 11 o'clock at night on a Saturday, had 80 people in a Casey's at 11 o'clock at night. I mean, it is extraordinary what we're seeing. And you know, there's some folks in Washington that talk about wanting to end Iowa's first in the nation status. I think that's absolutely batty. If we began the political process in a big state, in New York or California or my home state of Texas, these elections would be decided almost entirely by slick Hollywood TV ads. The men and women of Iowa take politics very, very seriously. And you know, I've joked, the men and women of Iowa, y'all treat politics like we treat football in Texas. Although, actually, you're doing very well in football as well, so you're taking both pretty darn seriously right now. But all of the men and women of Iowa who go to these town halls, there are literally millions of Americans counting on you. Because most Texans are never going to get a chance to meet a presidential candidate. And the men and women of Iowa, you know, there's an old joke, are you voting for so-and-so for president? No, I couldn't possibly. I've only met him 5 times. You know, that is an amazing thing, to sit in a drugstore or a gas station or a restaurant or a living room and have the good people of this state look the candidates in the eye and determine, are they telling the truth? Are they blowing smoke? That is a service for the rest of the nation, and I have grown to really love this state because of getting to know so many wonderful people here who have really good common sense values, who believe in the Judeo-Christian values and the free market principles that built America. And if we get back to Iowa values, we'll turn this country around. That is how we restore this great nation.
U.S. Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, thank you so much for letting me ride along and spend some time with you.
Thank you, and God bless.
And that winds up an interview conducted by Iowa Public Radio's Pat Blank Sunday night with Republican presidential hopeful and Texas Senator Ted Cruz. You can find the transcript of that conversation, also transcripts of interviews with other candidates, online at iowapublicradio.org. Coming up after a short break, talk with Dennis Goldford of Drake University about Cruz's chances and the climate summit in Paris. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. For the rest of the hour, Dennis Goldford joins us, professor of politics in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Drake University in Des Moines. I'm also Flansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake. Dennis, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon to you. I want to talk about climate change as the Paris summit is going on. But before that, last half hour, my colleague Pat Blank spoke with Ted Cruz, recorded last on Sunday. I wanted to get your reaction to some of the things that Ted Cruz said. Ted Cruz coming up in the polls. Why do you see that happening? What's going on?
Well, the field has been sorting out, as we've seen. We've seen Scott Walker drop out, Bobby Jindal drop out, Rick Perry drop out, and the conservative lane, at least the hardline conservative lane, as opposed to the more establishment conservative lane, is thinning a bit. You still have Mike Huckabee, Rick Santorum in that area, Ben Carson certainly. But at this point, the race seems to be coming down, at least in Iowa, to be in no particular order: Cruz, Carson, Trump, and Rubio. So it's sort of a natural thinning out of the field.
Mm-hmm. Anything else in that interview that you heard that jumped out at you?
Well, a couple of things, and I've heard him at many venues over the course of this past calendar year, and indeed extending back to when he appeared in Ames in August of 2014 at a family leadership summit. He's very consistent in his themes. First of all, he makes the argument that Republicans don't win because they've been not conservative enough. He makes the standard argument that every time the Republicans nominate what he considers to be a moderate or somebody in the middle or a rhino Republican in name only, and he thinks of John McCain that way, he thinks of Mitt Romney that way, he says every time Republicans nominate a moderate, they lose. Every time they nominate a true, consistent conservative, and if he had staffers on the stage with him when he said that, they'd all be pointing arrows at him when he says that, because that's his name for himself, he says they win. Now, he's too smart a guy not to have heard of Barry Goldwater. Nobody was considered more conservative than Barry Goldwater in 1964. He was Mr. Conservative and got creamed at the polls. He lost an electoral vote landslide. And the popular vote, I think, was close to 60% to 40% against him. So Cruz is betting on the proposition that most people don't agree with, that you can win an election on the right only, that if you motivate people he believes, particularly Christian conservatives who have not been voting, to turn out and vote, as well as Tea Party supporters and people generally fed up with Washington, you don't need anybody in the middle or anywhere else on the spectrum. That's the bet he's making. Again, many, if not most people, think he's not correct in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Dennis Goldford with us on this edition of Politics Wednesday here on River to River. Let's talk about climate change. After years of faltering negotiations, the UN Conference on Climate Change is expected to produce a landmark agreement during the next 2 weeks. It remains to be seen whether the gathering, 150 or so world leaders in Paris will achieve the target of limiting rising global temperatures to no more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels this century. So, Dennis, let's take a few minutes to survey the positions of some of the presidential candidates that they have on climate change. We have a few of their voices, a few of their quotes on climate change. But first of all, let me ask you, broadly speaking, what would you say? How would you describe the range of views we have about climate change in this presidential race?
Well, one position is that there has not been global warming. That's one particular position. And people argue the data, there have been references to alleged misstatements of climate data and falsification. Others say, no, that data is exactly right. And I'm not an expert in this area, so all I can do is report that.
Let me stop you right there in your tracks, because we do have one of those candidates here. It's, in fact, the one we've just been talking to. This is Ted Cruz making comments in a Yahoo interview with Katie Couric in June.
Satellite data show for the last 17 years, there has been no significant recorded warming. None. Now, that's a real problem, because the whole basis of global warming alarmism was based on computer models that showed there was going to be significant warming. And the problem is the satellites, when they're measuring the temperature, it's not happening.
Okay, so Cruz saying against, it seems, scientific evidence for warming of the climate is unequivocal here. Dennis, just to throw this out, I am not a climate scientist either, but I can read the data. Temperature data from 4 international science institutions all show rapid warming in the past few decades, and that the last decade has been the warmest on record. Multiple studies published in peer-reviewed scientific journals showing that 97% or more of actively publishing climate scientists agree climate warming trends over the past century are very likely due to human activities. But we have Ted Cruz saying this. Dennis, are you there?
Yeah. Oh, you said saying this. I thought you were leading into it.
No, saying this. Sorry.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, again, the one argument you hear from Cruz is that global warming is not happening. Okay. And as I said, you have some people who will argue that the data to which you referred showing that it is happening are using bad data. I have no idea whether that's the case or not. The second position is to say, yes, we've had global warming, but it's not due to human activity. So there's nothing really we can do about it. We haven't caused it, therefore there's nothing we can do about it. That's the second position. The third position is global warming is real, and because of the production of use of carbon-based fuels and all of that, it has been caused by human activity, and therefore if we change human activity, we can lessen, if not forestall, global warming. That's the third position, and that's the one really you have most Democrats taking.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to Donald Trump, the leader in the GOP column in this presidential race, saying it's really not a problem, and basically it's just some weather changes. These comments made on MSNBC's Morning Joe back in September.
Yeah, I consider climate change to be not one of our big problems. I consider it to be not a big problem at all. I think it's weather. I think it's weather changes. There could be some man-made something, but, you know, if you look at China, they're doing nothing about it. Other countries are doing nothing about it. It's a big planet.
Okay. Also echoing sort of that sentiment, let's listen to Chris Christie, governor of New Jersey. Well, he's saying it's sort of along these lines. That's not a big problem. It's not a crisis. Christie making these comments yesterday morning on MSNBC's Morning Joe.
The climate's always changing, and we cannot say that our activity doesn't contribute to changing the climate. What I'm saying is, it's not a crisis. The climate's been changing forever, and it will always change. And man will always contribute to it.
Okay, let's juxtapose that with Jeb Bush making these comments during a taping of IPTV's Iowa Press this morning. That show will air this Friday. When asked if the U.S. needs to reduce emissions, and by the way, in Waterloo earlier this week, Jeb Bush said he might not have chosen to attend the climate change conference in Paris.
We've reduced emissions by 10% in the last decade, not because of anything Barack Obama's done. It's because of the natural gas revolution that's taken place, and because people are conserving and consuming less energy in general, all of which is great, but it has nothing to do with imposed solutions from up above.
Okay, so there we have several of the GOP candidates. Dennis, why is climate change such a political football in this country when, as has been brought out in the climate summit in Paris, that in other countries there's really no dispute among lawmakers about the overwhelming view of climate scientists around the world that climate change is happening, that human activity is a primary driver?
Well, there seem to be two levels, one of opposition. One is at the level of material interest. There are various producers like oil producers and people who deal with carbon-based fuels. I think they fear that if you attempt to deal with climate change, it's going to hurt their bottom line. So, and they're in the position to try to lobby lawmakers either directly or through campaign contributions to attempt to influence to see their point of view on that issue. That's the level of material interest. But there's a more fundamental ideological dimension of this, and that is conservatives, and it's mostly conservatives who oppose or argue that there is no such thing as climate change. They see the concern with that as a kind of stalking horse on the part of liberals and others to fundamentally change the nature of the free enterprise capitalist system. They see a concern with climate change as an attack on free market capitalism in favor of those who want to increase the role of government. So it's a highly symbolic and ideological issue for those folks.
How significant? We didn't hear any Democrats. We better hear a Democrat. They are fairly consistent together. Sanders, Clinton, O'Malley. Let's pick out Bernie Sanders made these comments in an interview that I taped with him this morning. It will air tomorrow on this program. Here he is commenting about the serious nature of climate change.
I think this is a very, very serious problem. I think that if we are concerned about the kind of planet that our children and our grandchildren are going to inherit, it is absolutely imperative that we transform our energy system and we work with countries all over the world, which is presumably what's going on in Paris right now, to move away from coal and oil and gas.
Okay, Bernie Sanders there in a conversation I had with him this morning. You can hear that entire conversation tomorrow on this program. Let me finish up this talk on climate change, Dennis, by asking you, how significant do you believe climate change is as an issue in this election cycle? Will it decide many votes?
Yes, but perhaps not the way the people who favor dealing with it hope it will. This is a part of the core set of Democratic beliefs and liberal beliefs. On the other hand, you've got some folks who might say that, that's going to happen, if at all, when I die, when my children or grandchildren are gone. I'm out of work right now, or we're under assault from the possibility of terrorist actions. They might argue that's a lot more meaningful now than the prospective possibility of the temperature going up a degree or two. So, leadership involves getting people to see a lot further down the road than they normally do and getting people to sacrifice their short-term immediate interests on behalf of their long-term interests. The problem is, and this is the case with some of the Democrats, if you get too far down that road ahead of the people you're trying to lead, they lose sight of you and ignore what you're saying.
Dennis Goldford is with us. If you've just joined us, it's Politics Wednesday. Dennis Goldford of Drake University going through the latest on the political landscape for analysis. From Dennis, I want to ask you about the political repercussions of the attack last week on a Planned Parenthood office. Three people killed, nine wounded at the clinic in Colorado Springs on Friday. Robert Louis Deer expected to face multiple counts of murder and attempted murder in the attack. Reports that the shooter told investigators no more baby parts after his arrest, evidently showing that he had a anti-abortion agenda. Have you been surveying the reaction you're seeing from the candidates?
Well, not systematically, but quite a number of them actually have been pretty quiet in this regard. The Republican candidates, to some extent, have tried not to politicize this. They want to argue that this fellow was somebody who was disturbed, and you can't pin him on the pro-life movement. That's what they want to argue. Now, Democrats, of course, want to pin him on the pro-life movement and say, look at the kinds of incendiary things you've said. Look at the kinds of, they allege, misleading videos or fraudulent videos to try to whip up the troops, so to speak, against abortion and against abortion rights and Planned Parenthood. So they want to say that Republican rhetoric has some responsibility for this. So to some extent, several of the candidates have tried to avoid getting into this at all. Others really have tried to make some sort of political hay out of this. Mm-hmm. The one interesting thing I've seen is a suggestion on the part of people in Washington that this may well make it less likely that they really continue their attempt to defund Planned Parenthood this time around.
Right, right. And there's talk about that in Washington. So you think that this will have an effect of we've had months of opposition to funding the Planned Parenthood group, that this will dampen that opposition?
Well, it may well. It depends upon how hardline some people want to be. I mean, consider, again, Senator Cruz. He prides himself in pursuing his particular goal to the exclusion of anybody else, even in his own party. So if he wants to make an issue out of it, maybe he will. Maybe somebody else in the Senate will. But for right now, it appears this may have moved that aside to some extent.
Okay, let's talk about some news out of Washington concerning the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. Reading that Senate Republican leaders say they will finally realize their long-sought goal of sending an Obamacare repeal to the president's desk through some sort of maneuvering. Maybe you can enlighten us, Dennis. They only need 51 votes, the narrowest of margins. It's not clear they're going to get those. They've tried and failed dozens of times to get a repeal to the president's desk. The significance of this latest attempt?
It's symbolic. It's certainly symbolic. The 51-vote procedure is what they call a reconciliation process in the Senate, having to do with certain budget technicalities, in which case you can't filibuster it, so you don't need 60 votes. That's the way Obamacare actually got through to begin with the reconciliation, so they needed only a simple majority. Clearly, they voted, certainly the House has voted 50 times or more to overturn all or parts of the Affordable Care Act. The Senate now is, of course, in Republican hands since the election of 2014. And as President Obama said some years ago, elections have consequences, and the Democrats are bearing those consequences. But it's still the case that the president will veto any attempt to repeal his signature policy accomplishment. And I can't see how the Republicans would have any possibility of overturning that veto, of overriding it. But go back to Senator Cruz again. His argument is that people go to Washington and they don't do what they promised they would do. So here's an attempt by Republicans to say, yes, we voted against this, and it's only this Democratic president who's prevented the repeal. And if you elect a Republican president, we can guarantee you a repeal.
Mm-hmm. You pulled out that quote that elections have consequences. What about this in regards to the ACA? A new version of the Obamacare repeal would also gut an expansion of Medicaid. And Dennis, that has put millions of Americans from low-income households in insurance, health insurance, for the first time. Wouldn't that have repercussions on Election Day? Wouldn't Republicans be concerned about that, some Republicans?
Well, some would be, but I think it was the governor in Kentucky that was newly elected, Matt Bevin, was a Tea Party supporter, and he campaigned against the Affordable Care Act and the Medicaid expansion, and Kentucky was a prime case in which that's actually worked for people. And the question was whether he'd in fact slow down and not repeal this because of all the people you'd toss off the rolls. And it wasn't Bevin, but it was somebody either supporting him or connected with his campaign who said very bluntly, people on Medicaid don't vote.
Okay.
That's pretty much hardball right there. But that, again, lays out the importance of the vote.
Sticking with Congress, you hear some Democrats in recent weeks saying they could recapture the Senate in 2016. How do you really size up those chances?
Only a 50-50 chance, I think. I mean, the Democrats, I believe, have only 10 seats up for reelection, and the Republicans have something like 23 or 24 seats. However, a lot of those seats are in states that are solidly red or solidly blue, solidly Republican or solidly Democratic. So it's a question of what the swing states might be. I don't have them off the top of my head at the moment, but it's going to be, I think, only at best a 50-50 chance. At the same time, in a midterm election, you've got dynamics, and we've talked about this on the show before. A midterm election's dynamics favor Republicans because Republican voters are more likely to turn out than Democratic voters. In a presidential year, you get a more Democratic electorate than you would have in a midterm year. The question is whether it'll be enough to swing those Democratic Senate seats, to swing some Republican seats and open seats into the Democratic column.
And finally, Dennis, we have just a few minutes left, but I wanted to bounce off this latest utterance from the GOP leader in the polls, Donald Trump, ratcheting up his anti-Islamic State rhetoric another notch this morning. He remarked in an interview with Fox and Friends that if he were president, he would, regarding ISIL or Islamic State terrorists, also take out their families, knock the hell out of this terrorist group. Let's hear a little bit of that from Fox and Friends this morning, Donald Trump.
You have to take out their families. When you get these terrorists, you have to take out their families. They care about their lives. Don't kid yourself. But they say they don't care about their lives. You have to take out their family.
Okay, Trump saying in addition to targeting the terrorists in ISIL, their families should also be killed. Your reaction to that, Dennis?
Well, at one level, it's a matter of saying basically the U.S. should use the same tactics that they use. And I'm not sure how many of the American people would be in favor of that. On the other hand, you've got people who want a strong man. Trump appeals to that group of people. They want to have this sense, they have the sense that the country's under threat. They want to have the sense that some strong leader is going to do whatever it takes to beat back this threat, even if in practice that something is morally objectionable or in fact is not likely to happen.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Donald Trump has what many have said is a low ceiling in terms of the support he can bring?
You know, I would think so. Most political scientists, I think, have said that if Donald Trump were to win the nomination, let alone the presidency, it would overturn everything we political scientists thought we knew about the presidential nomination process. That's not necessarily a bad thing for our little intellectual models to be blown up occasionally, but it's hard to see how he has a very high ceiling because he has the highest negatives of any candidate.
Mm-hmm.
People who would never vote for him.
And yet in national polls, a new Quinnipiac out today, last week, the new Quinnipiac on likely Iowa caucus goers This has been 4 months he's been leading the polls.
Well, that's right. But as we've always talked about, remember, the nomination is not decided on the basis of a national primary. It's decided, as we know here in Iowa, state by state. And, you know, you can't say who's going to win the World – who's going to be in the World Series. It's the team with the best record in baseball and the second best record in baseball. But we don't do it that way. It's you go do by division and by league and by league. And we do our primary nomination process the same way. So national polls might help you with some fundraising, but in terms of really being on the ground with getting the nomination, they don't tell us much of anything at this point.
Okay. We have to go in just a few seconds. Dennis, what will you be watching most in the next few days?
Well, we've got a Republican debate coming up next week, and the question is the extent to which Trump really starts to go after Rubio and Cruz, and they go after each other, and whether how dynamic the conflicts arise between the, among those leading candidates at this point.
Dennis, always a pleasure to have your astute analysis on the political landscape with us. Dennis Goldford, professor of politics in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Drake University, also Plansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake. Dennis, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Ben.
River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, a short conversation with Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. Also, we'll look at the last time the Iowa Hawkeyes went undefeated in the regular season back in 1922. That's tomorrow on this program. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for listening.